Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Let us hear God's word. Who is as the wise man? And who knoweth the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom maketh his face to shine, and the boldness of his face shall be changed. I counsel thee to keep the king's commandment, and that in regard of the oath of God. Be not hasty to go out of his sight. Stand not in an evil thing, for he doeth whatsoever pleaseth him. Where the word of the king is, there is power. And who may say unto him, What doest thou? Whoso keepeth the commandment shall feel no evil thing, and a wise man's heart discerneth both time and judgment. Because to every purpose there is time and judgment, therefore the misery of man is great upon him. For he knoweth not that which shall be, for who can tell him when it shall be? There is no man that hath power over the spirit to retain the spirit, neither hath he power in the day of death. There is no discharge in that war, neither shall wickedness deliver those that are given to it. All this have I seen and applied my heart unto every work that is done under the sun. There is a time wherein one man ruleth over another to his own hurt. And so I saw the wicked buried, who had come and gone from the place of the holy, and they were forgotten in the city where they had so done. This is also vanity. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Though a sinner do evil 100 times, and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him. But it shall not be well with the wicked, neither shall he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he feareth not before God. There is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the word of the wicked. Again, there be wicked men to whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. Then I commended mirth, because a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry. For that shall abide with him of his labor the days of his life, which God giveth him under the sun. When I applied mine heart to know wisdom, and to see the business that is done upon the earth, for also there is that neither day nor night seeth sleep with his eyes, then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun, because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, further, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it. Thus ends the reading of God's holy and inspired word. Now this Lord's Day morning, we return again in our series of messages on the book of Ecclesiastes. We've looked at Matthew Henry's summary of the book before, but let me quote it again. He says, He, Solomon, one, shows the vanity of those things in which men commonly look for happiness, as human learning and policy, sensual delight, honor and power, riches and great possessions. And then, two, he prescribes remedies against the vexation of spirit that attends them. In this book we have vanities and we have remedies. In the first 6 chapters we have predominantly vanities with some remedies thrown in. Now in chapter 7 and following we have remedies with some vanities thrown in. Here in this chapter, in verse 1, Solomon opens with a praise of wisdom. He asks us 2 rhetorical questions. Who is the wise man, and who knoweth the interpretation of a thing? He asks us the question, who is the wise man? In other words, he's telling us about the rarity of someone that's wise. A wise man is a unique man because he's a rare man. He goes on, and in the second rhetorical question, he tells us that he's also a useful man. And who knoweth the interpretation of a thing? Who can rightly interpret something? Job in 33:23 speaks of the interpreter. He calls him also the messenger. He says he's a man of one in a thousand. He's rare that can rightly interpret God's word and can rightly interpret God's providence. Can make those right choices. We learn about some of those men, wise men, in 1 Chronicles 12:32. We read there, the children of Issachar. It says, they were men that had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. They knew the Word of God, and they rightly could evaluate what was going on in history so as to know what God's people ought to do. They were men of wisdom. They were interpreters. But then he goes on and says, a man's wisdom maketh his face to shine, and the boldness of his face shall be changed. Not only is the man that's wise a unique man and a useful man, he's also, I would contend here, a cheerful and dignified man. His face shines. His countenance reflects the joy of the Lord. He knows who he is, and he knows who he is in the light of God and in God's eyes. And so he's cheerful. His countenance is pleasant. He goes on to say, and the boldness of his face shall be changed. At first appearance, it may be suggesting that this man is courageous. And certainly a wise man is courageous. But literally, in the original, this phrase says that his strength of face is changed. What it seems to be suggesting is his harshness is softened. As a man grows in wisdom, his harshness is softened. In the Geneva Notes of the Bible, we have this note regarding this verse. They say, while before he was proud and arrogant, he will become humble and meek. A wise man, a man growing in wisdom, grows in humility and in meekness. And I think we have, don't we? Moses as that example of a courageous leader of God, and yet a man that God could say was the meekest man on earth. He wasn't weak, but he was meek. And a man of wisdom is a man that's unique. He's useful, he's cheerful, dignified, but he's also humble and meek. Here we have this praise of wisdom, and I believe he's telling us that he's going to then tell us how to be wise. He's been giving us remedies how to be wise in a mixed up, crooked world where things are not straight. And so he deals with us here in chapter 8 regarding how to be wise regarding authority. He tells us in verses 2 through 8 that we need to be in subjection to the authorities. And I've placed in there sinful authorities. What he's talking about is the fact that you live under authority, and every authority you live under is imperfect besides God. Every human authority is imperfect in its rule. He wants us to remember that. So we're to be subjection to the sinful authorities. And then in verses 9 through the end of the chapter, all the way through, we have that we're to learn to handle the sinful authorities. We're to learn how to accept the fact that they are sinful and how we should respond to them and what should characterize our attitude toward them and our attitude toward ourselves, given the fact we have to live under sinful authority in church, state, and in the family and in the workplace. Now let's consider what he has to tell us regarding subjection to sinful authorities. First, here in verses 2 through 8, he tells us a little bit about the duties that we ought to carry out. He gives us some duties that are specified, then he gives some reasons why we ought to do those duties, and then he tells us in several ways to be prepared to bear evil under authority. Let's look first at the duties he calls us to. He says, first, we must obey their commands. I counsel thee to keep the king's commandment. Literally, Solomon is saying, you're to observe the mouth of the king. We're to observe the mouth of the king. We're to have a readiness to obey. We're not only to obey his commands, we're to be waiting to obey his commands. We're to be eager and prepared to hear what he has to say so we can go do it. Obviously, we're only to do that if he's telling us something that's not sinful. We're not to follow him into a sinful path. We're not to be an accomplice of his crime. But we're to have this readiness to obey. Secondly, he tells us in verse 3, be not hasty to go out of his sight. Stand not in an evil thing. He tells us, secondly, don't be quick to take offense. Don't go out of his sight. Don't be insolent and disrespectful in taking offense. Don't leave the court because every one of your proposals is not warmly received. Don't leave the court because one of your proposals is vetoed and your feelings have been hurt. That's what he's saying. Don't get easily torqued and run away. That's what he's telling us. Don't be quick to take offense. He's not telling us that sometimes we couldn't be citizens in or under some authority and evaluate that it might be wise to go and place ourselves under another authority and rightly make that change of citizenship or change of job or even change of local congregation. He's not telling us that, but what he's telling us, don't get easily spun up and make a hasty decision in jumping jobs, in jumping countries, in jumping churches. Don't be hasty, he says, to do that. Think through it. Then he says in verse 4, where the word of a king is, there is power. And who may say unto him, what doest thou? Thirdly, Solomon says, we must not attempt to be their ruler or their overseer. We must not think that we have the right to be asking them, what are you doing? Their boss, their authority, asks them what they're doing. They ask us what we're doing. In this democratic society, we think we have the right to ask everybody in any sphere, what are you doing? We don't. We're not called to be their overseer or their authority. And oftentimes, we fail to understand the complexities of the job description of those that rule over us. In the workplace, in the church, in the family, anywhere, in the state. We misunderstand. We think it's easier to do their job than it really is. And we're so convinced we would do a much better job if we only had the job. But the fact is, even if that's so, God hasn't ordained it to be. We're going to see a little bit later that Solomon says, I see princes walking and I see ignorant men on horses. I see guys that ought to be higher up the pecking chain low. I see guys far up the pecking order that ought to be much lower. He says, it's upside down. It's not right. It's not all fair. But where you're at, you have to recognize you don't ask that kind of question. You don't jump into trying to rule or oversee them. But at the same time, fourthly, he says, I believe we must accommodate ourselves or prepare ourselves, take opportunities in correcting, in questioning, rightly, wisely, Whoso keepeth the commandment shall feel no evil thing, and a wise man's heart discerneth both time and judgment, because to every purpose there is time and judgment. You see, Job could say in Job 34:18, Is it fit to say to a king, thou art wicked? And to princes, ye are ungodly? It's a rhetorical question. He says, you don't ask those kind of things. You don't go tell somebody those kind of things. It's not fit to say, you're wicked, king. You're ungodly, prince. In one sense, it's not right to do that. And in another sense, we're sinning against them if we don't do that when we know from God's word we ought to. Was John the Baptist not obligated to stand against Herod? He was, clearly, and he did. And we must. We must, as ministers of the gospel, stand up against wickedness and call sin, sin, in the civil sphere as well as in the church sphere. And yet, Solomon is getting to the fact that there's time and there's judgment. There's a right time and there's a right manner in which to approach those that are over you in authority. And then, when we are wise in these ways, we'll be able to experience the joy of the answer of our mouth. In Proverbs 15:23, Solomon says, a man hath joy by the answer of his mouth, and a word spoken in due season, how good is it? When he thinks through how to approach those in authority, deal with them on something that needs to be dealt with, but he approaches at the right time with the right attitude. That's what God is calling us to do. Not to always try to be their overseer or their ruler, but when we in our place, in our submissive place, are called to question them, to ask them, to maybe even certainly reprove them, we must do it with wisdom. We must do it with care. We must choose the right time and the right manner. And what we must realize is that we must use prudence. And we must not confuse prudence with compromise and fear. Every time someone under authority doesn't immediately go and straighten someone out over them, they're not necessarily compromised. They may be, but we're not always. We have to think through, what should we address to them? What are the right biblical priorities? What should we address to them? What shouldn't we? What should we cover over? But when we must address something to them, we must have great discernment. We must consider time and judgment. We've looked at the duties. We must obey their commands. We must not be quick to take offense. We must not attempt to be their ruler or their overseer. We must accommodate ourselves to our opportunities in correcting them. We must seize those opportunities, but we must seize them wisely. But then Solomon gives us some reasons why we should do these things. And it's very interesting that Paul, in Romans 13, verses 1 through 7, as he calls Christians in the New Covenant era to submit to the civil magistrate, he uses the same three reasons. He says we should do it first for conscience' sake, then for wrath's sake, and then for comfort's sake. Solomon says in verse 2b that we ought to obey and do all these things for conscience' sake. He says, I counsel you to keep the king's commandment, and that in regard of the oath of God. You ought to do it because you've committed yourself to this ruler under God. Sometimes there's an explicit oath taken, sometimes there's not. As I considered this, I was thinking about the fact that immigrants who come to this nation have to take an oath, they have to take a vow of citizenship. We don't, because we were born into citizenship, but that vow is implicit to us. What they commit themselves to, we're committed to as citizens in this country. And so treason is sin for us because we've committed ourselves to submit to the authority under God, because we recognize the authority is from God. Though it's sinful, God has placed it there. And so It is in regard to the oath of God. And that reflects the fact that we should understand that as we submit to any authority in any sphere, we are submitting to God. That ultimately it shows us the level of submission we have to God when we consider how we are submitting to worldly authorities. Secondly, Solomon says, for wrath's sake. I think he alludes to this in verse 3b, and then possibly in 6b as well. He says, be not hasty to go out of his sight. Stand not in an evil thing. I failed to mention that when we were talking about duties, but I think stand not in an evil thing means don't be hasty to go, and then don't also be hasty or be vehement in terms of staying gone. Don't continue it. And if you go, don't think you have to stay out of his sight. Come back humbly. Don't stand in that evil thing. Okay, you made it. You did something evil. You're rushed out. But now, get it rectified. And this is the reason for, he doeth whatsoever he pleases. Because he's going to punish you the way he wants to punish you. He's not going to punish you or chastise you the way you want it to be. He's going to do whatever he wants to be done, whatever he thinks is right. In the sinful world, often what he wants is wrong. Sometimes it's too light, sometimes it's too hard. Quite often, it's not the right amount of chastisement. It's rarely that. But he does whatever he pleases. I think we see also an allusion to it in 6b. Because to every purpose there is time and judgment, therefore the misery of man is great upon him. Yes, there's an appropriate time to approach those in authority and deal with them about issues that you have with their rule. But he says, for who can tell them, therefore the misery of man is great upon him. Yes, there are those opportunities, and oftentimes we fail to seize them, and we blunder in at the wrong time and in the wrong manner, and we pay for it. And misery comes to us because we didn't consider time and judgment. So we're to obey for conscience' sake. We're to obey because it's right to obey, and God is pleased with our obedience. We're also to obey because if we don't, we're likely to pay the consequences of it. We're also to obey for comfort's sake. I think we can imply that from 6b. If we fail to approach those in authority rightly, there may be misery, but if we approach them rightly, it may be a profit to us. It may bring comfort to us. And I think that's certainly found or implied in verse 5. Whoso keepeth the commandment shall feel no evil thing, and a wise man's heart discerneth both time and judgment. So if we generally do what we should do, we'll normally keep out of trouble. That won't always be the case, but ordinarily that will be the case. And that's certainly what God calls rulers to in every sphere, is to provide comfort and blessing to those that obey, but they're also called to punish those that fail to obey. I think that's really at the heart of the prayer that Paul refers to in 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2, that we are as a church to pray for those in authority. And Paul gives us the reason why we're to pray for those in authority. It is that we might lead a peaceful and quiet life in all tranquility. We also want those that rule to make godly rules and then enforce those godly rules so that Christians can live godly and tranquil lives, so they can promote the gospel and not be hindered in taking the gospel and living the gospel in their country. And that's why we should pray and how we should pray for magistrates. We've had the duty stated. We've seen the reason stated. Now let's consider what Solomon's getting at when he tells us to be prepared to bear evils. I think we see some of this in verse 6b. I think he's telling us here that sometimes we blow opportunity. Therefore, the misery of man is great upon him. Because we don't rightly discern, and we don't go cautiously and at the right time. Sometimes we rush into a confrontation much too quickly. Those in authority are emotional, we're emotional. What's the likelihood of success? Sometimes we blow our opportunities and we bear evils because it's been brought upon our own head, because we've failed to take the right opportunity. But also, I think he's saying, secondly, in verse 7, that oftentimes we can't see the future. For he knoweth not that which shall be, for who can tell him when it shall be? And that could be translated, how it shall be. We don't know what's going to happen, and we don't know how it's going to be brought about. We don't know how it's going to be, as well as what is going to be. And so I think Solomon is telling us there's a time to get on with it, which if we miss, we will increase our misery. But sometimes we don't know exactly how things are going to turn out. Sometimes it doesn't look like those in authority have made a wise decision. And we think we know what they should do, and we think we know what the future will bring to them based on their decision, and what the future would bring if they made the decision we think they should. But the fact is, we can't see the future. And how many of us have thought, this decision that's been made will bring this about, and it doesn't come to pass? Because we don't know the future. Things are a lot more complex, aren't they? The equations of life are more than 1 + 1 = 2. There's all kinds of factors in what happens in a church and in a state and in a business, for good and for bad. And so it says we don't always know the future. But he says, lastly, as we're prepared to bear evils under a sinful authority, he tells us that the power of the authority is not ultimate. There is no man that hath power over the Spirit to retain the Spirit, neither hath he power in the day of death. There is no discharge in that war, neither shall wickedness deliver those that are given to it. You may be under a sinful authority. He's saying he doesn't have complete authority. He can't keep the Spirit within his body. He's not that powerful. He may be very powerful, but when God says your soul is coming out to meet its Maker, it will happen. That's what he said. Neither hath he power in the day of death. There is no discharge in that war. What he's saying is, you have no weapons in that war. You may think you do, but when you shoot, nothing comes out. You've got no bullets. You've got no gunpowder. You've got no missiles against God when he decides to take your life. When he decides to separate your soul and your body. He says they don't have that kind of power. So he's referring us back to God. As much power and authority as some may have in this world, they don't have ultimate authority, do they? Again, in the Geneva Notes of the Bible, we read this concerning this verse. Man has no power to save his own life, and therefore must not rashly cast himself into danger. And so Solomon's getting at something more than just the fact that there's not ultimate power in this authority. It's also saying he still has enough power and he could use it against you. And it could be his power used against you that kills you. You could get the death penalty. And I think what he's considering is the situation of a monarch, where there's one man, and in antiquity, children, in old days, that was common. And it's still common in many countries in the world, where one man makes the rules, enforces the rules. Our government's not like that. But there are governments like that. And when the wrong men get in power, things can be pretty miserable. Things can be very, very bad. But what he's saying is, neither shall wickedness deliver those that are given to it. In other words, the wicked leader may appear to be getting away with it, but he doesn't ultimately get away with it. God will take his soul from him. He will meet his maker. He will come into judgment. As much as it's true that we don't have the power to retain our spirits, let us be thankful that Christ has destroyed him who has the power of death. And that though we will have our souls separated from our bodies if we don't live until Christ returns, we will have that because of the fall of Adam and the consequences of that. Yet praise be to God, if we've closed with Christ, if we know him, if we're his, then the second death will have no power over us. Now we've looked at how to submit to sinful authorities in verses 2 through 8. Let us look now at how to handle sinful authorities in verses 9 through 13, or really 9 through the end of the chapter, through 17. He's already spoken briefly about poor rule. He's spoken about it in verse 16 of chapter 3. There Solomon says, "And moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment, that wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there." In other words, I saw in the courts where righteousness should have been exalted, I found wickedness. He said, that's the way it is under the sun. When you observe what's going on, generally, he's saying, that's the way it is. Then he speaks again of this in chapter 4, verse 1. "So I returned and considered all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of such as were oppressed, they had no comforter. And on the other side, or on the side of their oppressors, there was power, but they had no comforter." Solomon says first, that's just the way it is. That's the way it is living in a sinful world. Post-fall world, that's the way it is. First he tells us in verse 9, it's to the disadvantage of the ruler and the ruled. A wicked ruler doesn't help himself. He doesn't help his people, but he doesn't help himself. "All this I have seen and applied my heart unto every work that is done under the sun. There is a time wherein one man ruleth over another to his own hurt." He's not helping himself by ruling in that way. I think certainly there are some implications. One is that some men, some rulers, whether they're a single man or whether they're a board, are hard to live under. They're more difficult than others to submit to. But God calls us to submit to them nonetheless. We also recognize, as we consider the rest of Scriptures, we consider biblical history as well as post-canonical history, that God sometimes sends unrighteous governors as a judgment upon people. Because of God's people's sin, sometimes He has sent them kings that were wicked. And so he does to the nations. So he continues to do. And I think it's at the heart of what Solomon's focusing at here, and what I think is most important for us to remember, is that what he's saying is that abuse of power will rarely bring about the desired effects. You see, a ruler knows what he wants, and what he wants may be right. But if he seeks to do it in a way that's tyrannical, he doesn't get what he wants. He wants the right thing, but his pattern is to seek it in the wrong way. It's a disadvantage to the ruler and the ruled. We see also in verse 10 that oftentimes these men flourish in their abuse of power. "And so I saw the wicked buried, who had come and gone from the place of the holy, and they were forgotten in the city where they had so done. This is also vanity." He says they come and gone from the place of the holy. That's speaking about the place of judgment referred to in verse 16 of chapter 3. They were in the throne. They were in the place where God sits by His representative, pronouncing judgment in whatever sphere. And what Solomon says is, though they've been wicked in their rule, they die and people forget about how wicked they were. He says that's vanity. They recognize how wicked he was in office, but as soon as he's out of office, he's back on CNN, he's doing Larry King interviews, and everybody thinks he's a wonderful fellow. Maybe they'll even have a national holiday for some of those guys. We forget about history. We don't tend to learn from good men or bad what we should learn. He says they flourish in office, and yet we quickly forget about them. In other words, so we're likely to get the same kind of guy the next time. And we don't take it to heart. Then he goes on in verse 11. He says their prosperity often hardens them. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in evil, or set in them to do evil. Now this is a generic principle. It applies in all spheres, but in the context, the focus is upon the ruler. The ruler's wicked. He deserves to pay for it. But because God hasn't executed it against him yet, because that judgment may not come until the judgment day, he continues on in his sin. Maybe if he got what was coming to him, maybe he would straighten out. But he's not getting it, and he's not straightening out. He continues on in his prosperity, hardens him. As he abuses the long-suffering of God, he just continues to go on in his wicked ways. And we all know what it's like to have a government that's intrusive, and certainly it's more so than it was when this country was founded. And yet at the same time, are we not thankful that we live in a country where generally our freedoms are so much more than people throughout the world? And it's because God continues to pour blessing upon us because of our faithful forefathers and their fear of Him. Now, He's told us that we must remember this is the way it is. Then He tells us in verses 12 through 17, we better get used to it and get on with life. We better not just waste all of our time focusing upon that in such a way as to just ignore the fact that we're to get on and live our lives. And He tells us how to live our lives. First, He tells us in verses 12 and 13 that we're to live our lives in the midst of sinful authorities in the fear of God. Though a sinner do evil 100 times and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before Him. Though it seems like a sinner keeps sinning and sinning and getting away with it and lives a long life, Solomon says, but I know one thing. Those that fear the Lord will be well. We read similar words in Isaiah 3, 10 and 11. It shall be well with them that fear God. But he goes on. He says, let me tell you about the flip side of the coin. But it shall not be well with the wicked. Here he gives us an understatement. There's much more than what is said here when he says it shall not be well. What we can understand is that it shall be very ill. It shall be very bad with him that's wicked. Neither shall he prolong his days, which are as a shadow. Why? Because he feareth not before God. There's two kinds of people in this world, those that fear God and those that don't. Yes, in those that fear God, there is a difference between those that fear God a little and those that fear God a lot. But there's a diametrical difference between those that fear God at some level, the seed of God's been implanted in them at conversion, and those who have no fear of God. He says first, fear God. We've seen the fear of God pop up last week in chapter 7, verse 18. Here it pops up again. I think he's alluding to the fear of God because that's going to be the conclusion of the whole matter. He's leading to a crescendo at the very end of the book, and he's just whetting our appetite regarding the centrality of the fear of God. He says, not only fear God, he says, secondly, in verse 14, don't be surprised and charge God with injustice. There is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. Again, there be wicked men to whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. He says, that's the way it looks. That's the way it looks. Good men get evil, evil men get good. He says, but that's not the way it is. Don't be surprised that that's the way it will look on the surface, under the sun. Without God in the equation, that's the way it appears. So don't be surprised. Don't charge God with injustice when that's the way it looks like from the eyes. Have the eyes of faith. See through the facade and see the way it really is. Those that fear God will be well. Those that don't fear God will not be well. Then he goes on in verse 15. He tells us to cheerfully enjoy our present outward blessings. It might appear that this is a carnal deduction that he's making. Okay, if things are just topsy-turvy, then let's just live, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. It might appear that this is really the mantra of the Epicurean. But I think if we take it in the context, not only of this chapter, but particularly in the context of the rest of the book, I think we have to say that he's talking about the same thing that he's been talking about over and over again. He mentions it in chapter 2, verse 24, chapter 3, 12 and 13, and 22, and then chapter 5, verse 18. Saying the best you can do is work diligently, and what you acquire you should enjoy. God's given it to you. It's a gift. Enjoy it moderately, but enjoy it nonetheless. Cheerfully enjoy your present outward blessings. And he'll return to this again next week, in the next chapter. And then he concludes with telling us to patiently rest in the providence of God in verses 16 and 17. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done upon the earth, for also there is that neither day nor night seeth sleep with his eyes. He's saying intense effort is not necessarily the solution. He's going to call us to work diligently with our hands in the next chapter. He's not calling us to slothfulness, but he's saying it can be excessive, where you never have adequate sleep. Remember Psalm 127:2. I've quoted it in this series before. It is vain for you to rise up early and to sleep late, sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so giveth he his beloved sleep. He gives us sleep. We're to work diligently, but we're to sleep. Then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun, because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, further, though a wise man think to know it, he shall not be able to find it. He's saying, as you look at all these things, you think you can figure out how things work out, but he says you can't. It's beyond your comprehension. The way I like to think about it is those wheels within wheels in Ezekiel chapter 1. As Ezekiel looks at the throne, he says there are wheels within wheels. They're spinning one way and another wheel spinning the other way, and that's the way God's providences are. Things are going good for you and things are going bad for you in different spheres. Our country's going down the tubes. I hope your family isn't. I hope your church isn't. I don't think they are. How about your workplace? Your company may be bankrupt and you may be out of a job next week. That prosperity that you thought your company had, it may have all been fake and the bubble may be popped next week. Or that company that you think is struggling, just about to go under, there may be more wealth and more work ethic there than you realize, and that company may continue to thrive. We don't know. We don't know all the factors at work in daily living. In closing, in application, we've got to ask ourselves, are we wise? Are you wise? Are you submitting to God
by submitting to the given authority that you're under. Even though it's not perfect, even though it's sinful, are you submitting to it in whatever sphere you find? And the fact is, all of us in this room, except maybe some of the children, but all adults have some authority in some spheres, and then they're the ones that are to submit in other spheres. Think of you wives. You're to submit to your husbands, but you're parents of your children. So you rule over your children. Even elders in this church, we have to submit to the elders in the presbytery. We're not free to do whatever we will wish. We have somebody asking us, "What doest thou?" And so we all do have somebody telling us and asking us that question, and then there are those of us that are asking that question to others. And those of us that do rule in some sphere, we have to ask ourselves, are we ruling consistently with God's Word? Or does our rule pattern this tyrannical rule that Solomon is alluding to? We have to ask ourselves in all spheres. We've got to ask ourselves in the husband-wife relationship. We've got to consider this in the parent-child relationship, particularly with teenagers. When children begin to move to adults, when they begin to think for themselves, new issues arise. And it takes much wisdom on the parts of children and parents to rightly deal with that, to work through that transition from childhood to a mature adulthood. We also have to consider it in the worker-supervisor sphere. We also have to consider it even in the shepherds and sheep sphere. I've often thought it might be appropriate to give a lecture or maybe even a little booklet at some point on how to leave or not leave a church. How to leave or how to not leave a church. Because people leave churches all the time. And sometimes people leave them for the right reasons, and sometimes people leave them for the wrong reasons. And sometimes even when they leave them for the right reason, of being wise in all those relationships and recognizing the imperfection of life in this world under the sun, living under authority, that's sinful because it's fallen. Let us pray. Please rise for prayer.